For the week of March 15th, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 273, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And from the bitter cold reaches of the Arctic Circle, I'm Michael Giltz.
Is it cold in New York again? I didn't think so.
No, I'm in the Arctic Circle.
Okay, I don't really know what you're referring to.
Well, as Jay Penkasic pointed out, he's in Avondale, Arizona. He tweeted me and caught me on a mistake last week. I said that Big Hero 6 was Disney's second highest grossing Disney animated film hit since The Lion King. And I made a point of saying that didn't include Pixar films because I knew people would say, what about Toy Story? And in my head, I even knew people would say, what about Frozen? But I forgot Frozen is not a Pixar film, as we've discussed in depth. It is, of course, a Disney animation film from that banner. Jay pointed that out and he corrected me. And so here I am in the Arctic Circle. I won't forget that Frozen is a Disney animated film ever again.
Well, and you know, during the past week, while you were getting reprimanded, I was actually taking my course in ESP and psychic readings, and I'm going to make a prediction. I'm getting a vibe now based on what I learned over the weekend that Frozen 2 will make a lot of money.
That's right. Yeah, and if I was the father of a seven-year-old child, I would have remembered a Frozen movie in the first place. But I'm not, and I didn't. So thanks, Jay Penkasic, for pointing that out. And hopefully we won't make mistakes like that in the future. But we've got a show coming up right now. So what mistakes can I make this week?
Well, on today's show, we're going to be speaking with Eric Gardner, a senior editor at The Hollywood Reporter, who heads up the trade publications Esquire blog. So, Michael, if anybody sues you for making a mistake, you can maybe talk to Eric and he can refer you to a good lawyer. Mm-hmm. There are few journalists, in fact, out there reporting on the field of entertainment law with as much depth or knowledge, and he's going to be joining us to discuss the Blurred Lines verdict in which a jury ordered Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams to pay over $7 million to the Marvin Gaye estate, claiming the song sounded too similar to Gaye's 1977 classic Got to Give It Up. Meanwhile, the MPAA also gave their verdict for last year's box office figures. The good news is, despite the name of the organization, their annual report looks at the entire world, much like we do here at Showbiz Sandbox. The bad news, at least according to some, is that box office receipts only increased 1% during what was a record-breaking year. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office, just this past weekend's, not the entire year.
That's right. And we're looking at worldwide box office. We get our figures from RentTrak. We have a link to their website in our show notes. We also get info from Box Office Profits, Box Office Mojo, Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times, you name it. Anywhere we find an info on worldwide box office, we include it here. And the number one movie around the world is Cinderella. This is the live-action version directed by Kenneth Branagh. It grossed $132 million worldwide. It was the number one movie in North America. It was in the number one movie in a lot of territories where it opened. It's in 32 of those territories, and it grossed more than its budget in opening weekend. It was an expensive film. It cost about $100 million to make. There was a good ad campaign behind it, but it's off to a great start.
And by good, you mean we couldn't avoid it.
That's right. Did you see it with your kids?
I did not, no. Next weekend's task or chore.
All right. Number two around the world is also a success story. This is from Fox. It is Kingsman, The Secret Service. It grossed $20 million over the weekend. So you can see there's a big jump from number one to number two. Number one, $130 million worldwide. Number two, $19.9 million. But Kingsman is a good success. It grossed $275 million worldwide. It's quadrupled its budget. It will do that before its end. It cost about $80 million to make. It's going to get to $320 million at least. And still, the mystery remains. Why haven't they announced a sequel? At number three around the world is Chappie, which is not a success story. It grossed $19 million. It's at about $55 million worldwide and falling fast everywhere it's playing. And number four is the new Will Smith drama. You know, this is the con artist movie. It's called Focus. It grossed another $19 million. It passed the $100 million mark worldwide. It has officially doubled the budget that we've learned, which we think is about $50 million. However, this stars Will Smith, doesn't it, Sperling?
Yeah, yes, it does.
So
I don't know. Is this a trick question?
If their official budget is $50 million, and this is not some sort of lovable art project, what does that mean about how much money they need to make? That means Will Smith is getting a lot of his money on the back end, right?
It would seem so, yeah. If I were a Will Smith agent, which I am not, I would say, okay, fine, he'll take less money up front because he hasn't starred in something that's made a lot of money in a while.
No, he has. He's had a lot of big hits. We covered that last week. He's had one flop. The last 5-6 movies have all been success stories.
Right, but if you're trying to make a movie on a budget and you want Will Smith, what I would say is you got to give up some of the back end.
Right, he gets back end, period.
Right.
So we got to imagine he's getting even more back end if he's not taking up any money up front, because normally he'd get $10 to $20 million, depending
on
the type of movie.
Is he one of the producers on this? I would imagine he is.
Well, no? Sure. Nonetheless, he's going to want his money. So normally we would say, hey, you need to at least triple your budget worldwide in order for us to think, hey, yeah, this is definitely a hit. We don't get to look at the numbers. We don't know how much the ad budget was. We don't know the real budget. We just hear reports about what it might be. So we're all working in sort of fantasy numbers, but we do the best we can. In this case, they claim it cost $50 million, which means Will Smith did not get his money up front. So it's going to have to make at least $200 million worldwide for us to feel like this is a solid hit. Right now, it's at $100 million and it's still doing well. It's in 62 territories. We'll have to see where it ends up. And number five is a Liam Neeson film. That's doing all right, but it's a little softer than his recent action flicks. It's called Run All Night. It made $17 million on its opening weekend, and it's got a lot of territories to go.
Now, you know, I actually read something over the weekend that you said it's a little soft, that he's basically been doing action movies, Liam Neeson, right?
That's right. In the last 5-10 years, it's been action, action, action. He fights off wolves, he fights off terrorists, you name it.
Well, I was surprised to hear that he maybe has another 2 years left, he says. This is a quote from him, that he's going to maybe stop doing action movies in another 2 years, which shocked me because he has a very specific, particular set of skills that he has acquired over, well, a very long career, skills that make him a nightmare for people and villains all over the world.
Okay.
No, it's because
no.
It's from Taken. You see,
yes. So he may feel like they've run their course, and you know, certainly given the reviews for the last few, they all feel like yeah, he's kicking ass again. But this one got slightly better reviews than the last one or two, so it would be a better way to go out on top. But he's not done yet. He is 62 years old. At some point, you look a little silly playing action films.
He doesn't look 62.
He certainly doesn't, and he could kick my ass even in real life, I'm sure.
Well, he has a very particular set of skills.
At number six is Big Hero 6. This is another Disney film. This is an animated movie. It's got $17 million over the weekend, $630 million worldwide. I wonder if they'll make a live-action version of Big Hero 6. It seems like every Disney property, they get live action, then they make them animated. They get animated, and then they make them live action. Then they turn them into a Broadway musical. Then they put them on TV. Then they take them back to the movies.
Well, I can tell you that kids love imitating the robot about, you know, I am your personal healthcare companion. They're always like, oh, are you hurt?
That character is very sweet. So maybe that makes a good spinoff to a TV show. But you won't be surprised to hear that there is another Disney animated film, just like Cinderella, our number one movie of the week, being turned into a live action film.
And that just seems dumb, Bo.
Dumbo. Tim Burton is directing Dumbo. You drank your borscht belt comedy soup this morning.
I don't know, but I was at the Catskills over the weekend.
Yeah. So Tim Burton is directing a live action version of Dumbo. Disney felt like they needed to announce this, even though there's really no script. They really haven't done anything yet, but they've locked up a director that's made a lot of big movies. And PETA immediately jumped up and said, hey, wait a second, you better change the ending.
Well, this is the group that... Some people are tree huggers. PETA's the animal huggers.
That's right. They love animals. And they say, hey, at the end of the original animated film, I think Dumbo was a star in the circus, right?
Yes, something he was. Like that. He had big ears, by the way. Dumbo.
Yes. And they say, hey, that doesn't work anymore. Let him be retired and go to a nature preserve, because even Ringling Brothers isn't going to be using elephants under the big top anymore. So I'm sure they will tweak the story. It's a very short film.
It is.
I really am not a big fan of Dumbo. I don't think it's one of the better ones. Others love it, but I feel like it's pretty thin stuff. But, you know, and there's a couple good songs, obviously. There's, you know, Baby Mine and Pink Elephants on Parade. But, you know, it's a pretty short story. But, you know, when you got live action, I guess it'll take a little more time to have that elephant get rescued.
Well, I can tell you it's great for parents because, A, it's a short movie, and B, at the very beginning, the stork brings the baby elephant to the mother. And, you know, when you're with your kids who are, you know, 5-6 years old, and they're asking, so that's how babies are born? You just go, yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. The stork bought you too.
At number 7 is 50 Shades of Grey. There will be at least 2 sequels to this movie. It grossed $11 million over the weekend. It's at $550 million, just shy of that, worldwide. There will be a sequel, and they will cost more money, won't they?
Yes, they will, because if you are an actor or an agent representing an actor in that particular franchise, you go, wow, you made so much money off of that first one where my client really only earned $250,000 because we weren't sure whether it was going to be a hit or not, what with the whole, you know, sexy sex, naughty, naughty stuff. So, but now that we know it's going to be a hit, how about you pay us more money?
Right. And the actors and their agents rather say, hey, look, we're looking at raises similar to what Jennifer Lawrence got. She starred in the Hunger Games trilogy. In the first one, she made about $500,000. And then the second one, she made $10 million.
Which, by the way, okay, the $10 million, that's a huge jump. But $500,000 for someone like Jennifer Lawrence at the time.
She wasn't a big star at the time.
Well, it's a huge amount of money, actually.
Well, it's not a huge amount of money.
Well, for somebody
you're starring
her,
in a big, massive tentpole movie, and you're going to be the central character that's going to be in all the films, and the whole thing rides on your shoulders. You know, you're making a $50-$70 million movie. You really think $500,000 for the lead is a lot of money?
Well, no, maybe for somebody of her stature at the time. Again, remember, she wasn't
a lot of. I don't think it's a lot for any actor, unknown or world. You know, you're asking them to be the linchpin of a franchise. $500,000 is not that much money.
Well, and I think that's why she was paid so much, because I know some actors these days that I know of, they get a $400,000 offer to star in a film, and you know, you'd think that they were like $1 million players, and they're actually quite happy to get it.
Well, but it's not a summer tentpole franchise that they're doing.
No, not at all. No, and it's a one-off, and yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, they want more money. They will get more money. Though, of course, there's no movie yet. There's no director, no writer, no script. And now the studio says that the 50 Shades sequel will not be released until probably Valentine's Day of 2017. That really seems like a mistake to me. They couldn't get this sucker ready to go for 2016.
As if somehow they didn't know the film was going to be a hit, since it's based on this best-selling trilogy.
Well, of course, they never know. I mean, it could have been a total flop. It could have been a joke. People could have laughed at it, or rather than laughing with it and enjoying it. But nonetheless, it doesn't cost any money to have scripts ready.
That's true.
That's you know.
Well,
you just
it costs money, but it doesn't cost a lot of money.
No. Yeah, but when you're rolling the dice on a movie like this, and you got a hot property, and you know you've got 3 books. For God's sake, you should be having it lined up so that if you want to go forward, you're ready at least with scripts. And of course, they had a lot of trouble with the first one, and now the author wants to write the second one. I assume they will film both sequels at once, unless they're complete fools, right?
Yes, there would be no reason not to film both sequels at once.
Right. It's basically 2 actors. You're in a room spanking. How, you know, it's not a lot of setup. You know, move the camera over there, move it over here.
And in this case, if you think that spanking is a euphemism for something, you'd be both correct and incorrect. But yes.
That's right. So that's a big movie. That will happen. I pray they don't try to stretch the third book into a fourth movie.
Oh, God, no.
Right. So, you know, everybody tries to stretch out their properties and make them last. That's certainly the case for Paramount. They've got a lot of franchises, and they also have their annual shareholder meeting. And the suspense there is not what's happening and not happening, but the fact of who's showing up and who's not.
Well, yes. And we're not talking about people like Adam Goodman, who, well, I guess he's with Paramount still, but as a producer. He's got a producing deal there now, but he was the head of the studio for a while, the head of production. And yes, there's a number of layoffs and some executive shuffles, but really all eyes are on that dais looking at the board of directors, specifically one empty chair, and that is the chair of the owner, Sumner Redstone.
That's right. He's 91 years old. His spokesperson says he has, quote, decided not to attend, end quote. He did the same thing last year, but there was such an outcry that he ended up showing up anyway. But clearly, you know, he's got health issues. They say his mind is sharp as a tack, but, you know, he's just not mobile anymore, particularly. And he's not up for attending the event. You know, they can claim that he's perfectly healthy and fine, but clearly if he was healthy, he would be there, and he's not. So again, this is going to be a huge scuffle once that happens, and they're fighting over what happens to the future of Paramount. Certainly at Viacom, they've been having layoffs all over the place. And a lot of areas have had, you know, cuts. And now Paramount Pictures is having the latest round. 30 to 40 people were fired. You know, it's not good. And of course, you know, annual shareholder meetings aren't that exciting anyway, are they? I mean, Disney just had theirs.
No, which is why you're hearing about Dumbo, by the way.
That's right.
And Frozen 2. You heard about Frozen 2 as well at the same time.
Yeah, the least, you know, least surprising statement ever. We will be making a sequel to Frozen.
Yes.
Thank you very much. We're not complete idiots is what they're saying. And by the way, did you know Frozen? That comes from the Disney animation label of Disney. It's not a Pixar film.
I did know that, actually. I did.
Yes, you did. I didn't.
But, you know, I think there are some people that would just say, look, Frozen was really good. You don't need to do another one. Let it go.
Well, I agree. It's not a natural for a sequel. You know, but, you know, it worked. So they'll try to make maybe the next one will be really hot.
Oh, yes. But then would they be able to have Olaf?
That would be part of the excitement. He'd have to be like in a glass snow globe.
Yes, that's right. That would be funny.
There you go.
And you're hired. Movie,
and when that movie opens up, it will help boost the box office, won't it? Because it grossed $1 billion worldwide.
That's true. Yes, it did.
And that takes us to global box office, doesn't it? It
was. Oh, a record I see what year. You're trying to do there. Yes, yes. Go ahead.
It was a record year, right? A record-breaking year. But, you know, last year, or was it? What was the year before? Was last year a record-breaking year too?
Well, they're record-breaking, but in different areas. So, yes, it made more money than you know, by like, I guess, what, $1 billion or something like that? It made more money or
1% over last year. So the worldwide box office set a record in 2013, and then it set another record in 2014. But people said, well, yeah, but just barely.
barely.
That's the lunacy of the world, where they're like angry it didn't jump, worldwide box office didn't jump 20%. Well, it can't do that every year.
Yeah, I also think it's a matter of the people who are reporting this, where they're located geographically, because very often you look at the people reporting and saying things like that, and they're in the West, and I mean Europe, North America.
Which was the areas where box office was soft and down.
Yes, or at least stagnant, you know, because, yeah, it was down this year, but it was up a little last year. So if you look, you know, over time, it's a little stagnant. And, you know, yes, they've been 42,000 screens in North America for how long now? And it's a movie going public, and movie going is kind of not new where it is in, say, Latin America or in Asia.
That's right. So worldwide box office was $36.4 billion. It's a new record. And like we say, North America was down. Europe was sort of down this year, about 3%. And they break it down territory by territory. We have the links in our show notes. Latin America had some good growth. Asia had very good growth with a 12% jump in box office, led, of course, by China, which grew 34%, hit the $4.8 billion mark. And meaning that's alone makes it worth as much of all Latin America 1.5 times over.
Yes. Yeah, so basically it's near, well, yeah. Okay.
It's number two. And in 5 years, it's going to probably keep growing and growing by leaps and bounds. And in 5 years at the most, it'll probably pass North America to be the number one box office market in the world.
And that's China, not Asia. The Asia Pac Rim would become the highest grossing.
Even sooner.
Yes, exactly.
That's right. So what is the screen count worldwide?
I think it's 142,000 screens, commercial screens, which is shocking.
So a third of all screens in the world are in North America?
Right now, yes. And that's why it's a very mature market. And, you know,
and why there's a lot of room for growth.
A room for growth elsewhere, yes.
Right, yeah. A lot of room for growth in China and India and a lot of other, and Latin America. If a third of all the screens in the world are in the U.S. and Canada, you know, there's lots of billions of people who are underserved right now, aren't there?
Yes, and I would point to Patrick von Sikovsky's work on Celluloid Junkie, and yes, that is a plug for the outlet that I write for, because his work specifically about China and how there may be some undercounting going on, some fraud going on, at least 10%, you know, where basically the theaters aren't actually reporting 10% of the grosses.
What part of the world is that happening?
In China.
Oh, in China.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's a big problem. We've talked about that before, about reporting of screens and actual attendance and money slips away.
Yeah.
So it's bad enough you're only getting 25%, about the lowest level of return on your investment. When you bring a movie to China, the U.S. companies or the international companies tend to get at most 25% of the box office. But that box office may not include all the money that was made.
Yes, and that's, I mean, his work there has been stellar on reporting on the, Asia and China, specifically related to cinema exhibition.
So worldwide box office is growing.
Yes.
China is a big market, and North America is down. Domestic emissions fell 6%. They only sold 1.27 billion tickets. And the average ticket sold per person also slipped. That makes sense. The Hollywood Reporter, who we're going to be talking to Eric Gardner from The Hollywood Reporter later in the show about blurred lines and that verdict. The Hollywood Reporter had a good story looking at some of the reasons and some of the areas of concern for box office in North America.
Well, and the first one was the 32% problem.
What the heck is that?
Well, why don't you tell me? Because I'm a little confused by the whole thing.
Well, you know, as they point out, admissions hit a 19-year low in North America, the fewest tickets sold in 19 years.
And that's really the for me, the kind of concerning part is you want a healthy culture of movie going. Like when I go to live theater and I literally, my presence brings down the average age of the attendees by like, you know, 20 years because I'm not in my 70s.
Always thus at live theater.
Yes.
I don't know why, but live theater for 30 years, I've never seen anything. I'm always the youngest person in the crowd. You know, that's just the way it is. But the problem is, of course, most people don't have access to live theater and it's very expensive. It's only in major cities. You know, they tour now, of course, so that's a much bigger market. But, you know, often when you're talking about live theater in the U.S., you're talking about, you know, New York City and Chicago and a few other places. So you got to travel there and then you got to spend a lot of money. So it tends to be a more mature audience. Movies, of course, are everywhere. The problem is the 32% problem. 32% of the population in the U.S. and Canada didn't go to the movies in 2014. Not once.
And that's
they didn't
the
see
thing.
A single yeah. film.
That's what you want to overturn. That in my not overturn, but you want to lower that percentage. You want people to think of movie going as a recreational activity. Much
you
like
you don't want one out of three people to never go to the movies.
Right. You want them to think, oh yeah, no. Well, what do I do for fun? Well, let's see. I take a vacation. I go to the movies. You want that to be one of the things they do for fun.
I think it's more. Should I go to eat at Chipotle? Should I go to the movies? Vacation is only once or twice a year. Movies should be like every other week, as far as studios are concerned. The question is, and I know you don't know the answer, but I'm going to ask anyway. What was the figure 20 years ago, 40, 30 years ago? You know, is this a big, burgeoning, growing problem, or is this where it's always been?
That's a good point. I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head, and I would be interested to know. Because, for me, it's always about long-term movie-going trends. We want movie-going to remain healthy as an activity.
That's right, which is why I'm not too concerned that box office ticket sales, you know, actual tickets sold, hit a 19-year low because overall over the last 20 years, just like you've seen for the last 40 years, the box office ticket sales are keeping pace with population growth in general. So we're not seeing people suddenly stopping going to the movies just because this was a down year. But it is a down year for little kids. You've got kids, Sperling.
Well, I was just going to say they're not stopping going to the movies, but different demographics are keeping the ticket counts stagnant or up.
Right. They're always worried that movies focus too much on teenage boys and they're ignoring adults. And now they're worried that they're, you know, reaching adults, but they're ignoring teenage boys. But kids are an issue, aren't they?
Yes. I guess, what was it? The group makes up 11% of the population. 51.
What group?
The toddlers, the kiddies, right?
What age group is that? Like tweens, little kids?
I think 2 to 11, right?
Okay.
When they
talk
about that age group.
Okay.
And there was a steep fall with only 2.7 million young children going to the movies compared to a year before 4.3 million.
Wow. Okay. So that's in that one particular age group. So we're talking frequent moviegoers overall are people who buy a lot of tickets and they're defined as 11% of the population, but they buy half of all movie tickets. So 1 out of 10 people go to the movies constantly.
Right.
A third of people don't go at all. And if you're little kids, suddenly last year you were turned off by movies. The four-year-old said, yeah, I'm done with movies. So why would it be? Were there fewer family films?
I think that's it. I think if you look at it, you go, oh, so the year before when Frozen was a big winner at the box office, 4.3 million tickets. And this year there was no Frozen and you sold 2.7 million. I wonder why.
Was Frozen 2013?
Yes, it was.
Yes, it was. And it was earlier, it wasn't a Christmas release, so most of the sales didn't come in 2014?
Well, a lot of them came between November, December, and yes, mm-hmm. January, February, but not nearly as many. I mean, at that point, you were in your 10th, 11th, 12th week.
Well, I know that they talk about Gen X and Gen Y and Gen Z, and when you're looking at frequent moviegoers, you want people to, you know, be young people, and then they carry that trend through their whole life. And they say, hey, look, if you look at frequent moviegoers, there was a big drop-off for people aged 25 to 39. That's also including parents like you, parents of young kids. right? So you got young 2 to 11-year-olds are not deciding not to go to the movies. Their parents are deciding not to take them to the movies. You are deciding not to take them to the movies, Sperling. It's your fault.
Yes, I frankly blame only myself for all of North American box office.
But there was a drop in the frequent moviegoers in that middle age range of 25 to 39.
Yes, it's also the time when people are starting families. They have less time. They may have less money, frankly.
No, but that would be a systemic explanation. But in this case, there was a big drop. So they were going more. And now from the year before, they're going less.
Maybe it's just the movies.
Right. But they say, maybe it's just age. That's what I would say. They say, oh, look, people going to the movies a lot dropped precipitously in 25 to 39, but it's gone up. It's soaring, in fact, for people who are 40 and over. And
yes.
I say, well, maybe the people who are frequent moviegoers are just getting older. So you're going to have a bulge of people who are in a big habit of going to the movies. They're getting older. So eventually they're going to leave one age group and enter the next one. It's like the baby boom, right? That generation, they sort of set the trend at every stage of their lives. Maybe this frequent moviegoer bulge is just an age group that's getting older. Those people, it's not that they wanted to go to movies because they were seven. They wanted to go to movies because that was their thing. And now those people are getting older. It's just a demographic shift because they're getting older.
Right. And I'm trying to say, hey, let's make going to the movies the thing of what kids who are 12 right now want to do. Instead
right.
of play video games or watch Netflix or, you know.
But if you're wondering why 2 to 11-year-olds aren't as excited about going to the movies, it's certainly the quality of the films and the type of the films, but it's the experience. And that takes us to my favorite area. And we're really going deep on this Hollywood Reporter story. It had five problems, and they were all in detailed by Pamela McClintock. And so we've been really going through this article pretty thoroughly. So, we appreciate her work there, and we got a link to the show notes, but, check out her work at The Hollywood Reporter. But this is my favorite explanation for why box office was down. What is it?
In 2010, 52% of moviegoers in North America saw a 3D title. Last year, the number fell by almost half of 27%.
No, that's right.
Even though there were more 3D titles than ever, 47. In 2013, 31% of those going to the cinema saw 3D titles. So it's going, let's see if I were to do the math. It's going down, actually. It's going down.
Well, okay, that was a little dizzying there. Okay, so we got a little caught up in the numbers. In 2010, half of everyone who went to a movie saw a 3D title. In 2013, only a third of people who went to the movies saw a 3D title. Last year, only about 25% of people who saw a movie saw a 3D title, even though there were more 3D titles than ever, which means they got a lot more movies attracting a lot less attention. We've seen at the box office time and again for the last 2-3 years. And this is not an explanation of why box office is down. This is why an explanation of 3D movies are down. People don't like it. They don't care. It's not worth the extra money. And 95% of the time, it's a pointless added flourish to the movie that adds nothing to the movie-going experience. And for little kids, it sucks. They hate it, don't they?
Yes.
Yes, they do. So guess what? 3D is a fad. Once in a blue moon, they will make a movie in 3D, and it will be worthwhile, and it will be well done, and you'll say that's worth seeing in 3D. We've seen it in big movies like Avatar, which I actually, didn't really care for the 3D. It was fine. Or animated films like Up. 3D was used well there.
Or Coraline. People talked about Coraline being a great example.
Coraline was really good use of 3D. And we see it in art films. The documentary, it wasn't Wim Wenders, it was Werner Herzog, The Cave of Forgotten Dreams, a beautiful use of 3D. We've seen a couple art films that really use it in interesting ways, but it is not something that most movies should have. It's 90% of the time an afterthought. It adds nothing to the experience. 3D is a fad as far as movie going in general is concerned, and they really need to drop it.
Well, and it's actually down worldwide in 2014. Down 2% from the
really?
Previous year, yeah, to 14% of the total box office worldwide.
Because that was a big area of growth for them. People in the rest of the world hadn't gotten sick of 3D yet. It was still a novelty for them.
That's right.
And I bet studios are thinking, maybe it'll just stay a big thing in China and stay. No, I bet
no.
They'll get sick of it there too because it costs more. And even if it was the same price, I would still choose to go to 2D, wouldn't you?
In most cases, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to make a
time,
good case.
Even if they weren't charging a premium, believe me, I avoid 3D. When I go to a free screening of a movie, sometimes I don't go because the only thing they're offering is the 3D option. And so I said, well, to hell with it. I'll wait to pay. I will pay more just to see it in 2D. That's literally the case with 3D. And I don't think I'm unusual.
I don't think so either.
Yeah, it's a fad. It was stupid. Drop it. And when you bring it back, don't charge us extra.
Well, what about this gender question? Are we going to talk about that?
Well, I don't understand what the question is. It says since 2010, females have consistently made up a larger share of moviegoers. Well, guess what? There are more women than men. They should make up a larger share of moviegoers.
So then that's not a big deal then?
Not to me. Oh.
That's right. I was moving us along into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story. Sony is doubling down on Ghostbusters.
Good God.
The studio is low on tentpole franchises, which is one reason why rebooting Ghostbusters has always been a fixation for them. Of course, Ghostbusters was never really a franchise. It spun off a long-forgotten cartoon series and one very bad live-action sequel, and that's pretty much it. Nonetheless, anticipation is high for the all-female reboot starring Melissa McCarthy. But now, Sony is insisting that just like Marvel and Spider-Man, there's a Ghostbusters universe. They want multiple films, fast. A male reboot is also happening. Producer Ivan Reitman and a team has been designated to do nothing but think up Ghostbusters spinoffs, and they've moved on to the Sony lot just for that very reason. Ironically, they complained about Seth Rogen's office when they did that. Big deal or big whoop?
Take a guess.
Big whoop.
I mean, my God, they can't even make one decent sequel. What makes them think they have a universe? It's ridiculous. Make one good movie and maybe we can talk about it. You know, I mean, the idea that they're going to have multiple it's taken them 30 years to make a decent film and they haven't even done it yet. So what in God's name makes them think they should be creating a franchise that involves a universe of Ghostbusters properties? To me, this is the really, when you're talking about a dearth of ideas, this is a great example.
So when they came up with that idea, the executive, somebody must have said something. What universe do you think you're living in that this is a good idea? And they went, exactly.
or they were in Seth Rogen's office when they came up with it.
Good point. Now, I almost knew this next story was coming. I could almost predict it when we first reported what stemmed from this. Well, just hear me out. Based on a claim of elder abuse, the state of Alabama has begun investigating the mental health incompetence of author Harper Lee, the writer and author of the blockbuster novel To Kill a Mockingbird. After decades of silence, a prequel was announced for publication, rather shocking for an author who rarely gave interviews and swore she'd said what she wanted to say with her one hugely successful book. And when we reported it a couple weeks ago, I thought to myself, when do we get the articles and the stories about how she was being taken advantage of? In fact, some began to question whether Lee was competent mentally and could agree to such a dramatic change in her legacy at 88 years old. After suffering from a stroke and having severe hearing loss and short-term memory issues, some say she's perfectly lucid. Others say she's confused from one minute to the next. It all takes place in the context of the July publication of Go Set a Watchman. That's this book we're talking about, this sequel. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop. It's just something that was bound to happen. Somebody made a claim of elder abuse. They got to investigate. And frankly, the publishers should welcome it because their argument, well, you know, we haven't spoken to her really except once, but we're sure she's great about it. You know, it just wasn't feasible. So they should be glad that Alabama's stepping in and glad that they can give a ruling that hopefully will back them up and say, no, she's competent mentally. She has agreed to this. She is clear on what's going on and she is, you know, so hopefully that will be the rule. If it's different, then they're really in trouble.
Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. And her sister, Harper Lee's sister, passed away in, what was it, October, November? And her sister was her longtime, like, protector. So they're saying, look, her sister passes away and less than 6 months later, you've got a sequel coming out. There's something fishy going on here. So they wanted to investigate. And I think you're right. It's probably best that they do.
Yeah. And the best thing all, of course, would be good reviews. If it comes out and it gets good reviews and everybody will say, oh, it doesn't harm her legacy. It really is good. Blah, blah, blah. But every review is going to talk about this.
That's true.
Especially if it's not good. They're going to say, yeah, you know what? Better kept in the drawer. But even if it was, when she died, it was going to see the light of day anyway.
That's true. That is absolutely true.
And now we get to the all TV, all the time section of Big Deal, Big Whoop. We could have made it an all TV, Big Deal, Big Whoop lineup, couldn't we?
Yes, but we had to throw in the Harper Lee story and the Sony story. Just had to.
Yeah, we had to.
Yeah.
So let's get on to television.
Okay, well, HBO's documentary series, The Jinx, about alleged upper crust killer Robert Durst. I loved your use of alleged there, by the way. Very professional.
He's still alleged.
Yes. Well, it ended in as dramatic a fashion as one could ask for, especially if you're a documentary filmmaker, if you know what I mean.
And HBO.
Yes. Durst was arrested again in real life, and on the show, he seemed to confess to all three murders he'd been accused of committing. Documentaries sometimes have real-life impact by freeing the innocent or helping to shine a light on the guilty. But rarely does it happen in such dramatic fashion, almost designed to boost the ratings of a TV show's finale. Indeed, the arrest and then the show's climax made front page news in the New York Times on the same day. Big deal or big whoop?
I don't know if it was on the same day because, the arrest took place a day or two before, didn't it?
No, it took place Sunday morning, and then the finale aired Sunday night.
Oh, really? I thought it was Saturday. In fact, the HBO's filmmakers, the guys behind it were like, yeah, no, we had reached out to police after talking to our lawyers, and there were legal issues involved about when they should share evidence that they had come up within their investigation. You know, there were certain things, if they told the police at this stage, then it would mean certain legal things, and therefore evidence might not become admissible in court. So it wasn't a simple thing of, oh, I found this out, I got to go tell the cops. They had to weigh what would be best as far as getting justice done, but they did provide police with info months ago. And frankly, they were surprised he hadn't been arrested yet. So it certainly was not, you know, somebody said, oh, they were collaborating and arranging to make it, you know, tie into the finale. No, they were not. The police was not tying it in to the season finale of the series. You know,
in fact, it was the season finale that made police go, you know, maybe we should get off our derrieres here. Yeah. He may, after kind of seeing this final episode, decide he should leave the country. Maybe we should go get him, pick him up.
Is that really what they said?
Yeah. And so
I knew they were worried about him fleeing the country, but I didn't know they were thinking literally, yeah, you know what? Once he sees this on the air, he's going to bolt. And he did. He went to New Orleans under a fake name. He was probably going to try to leave the country because in the final episode, they have him on audio saying, yeah, I killed him.
Yeah.
It may not be admissible in court, but the funny thing is he'd had a mic on, went into the bathroom, and it took them several months before they realized they had this audio. They were just had people going through all the footage and things that they had to make sure they weren't missing anything, you know, crossing their T's, dotting their I's. And somebody said, oh, my God, by the way, have you heard this audio? He says he killed them all.
But was it like, you know, sarcastically said? Yeah, what do you think happened? I killed them all, of course.
No. This is him alone in the bathroom going, what have you done? Well, you killed him. You know, no, it sounds like a confession.
Was he talking to himself?
Yeah, he was in the bathroom with the door shut. He either forgot or didn't care that he knew the mic was on. They always left it on, but they didn't even know they had caught the audio. You know, it was months before they realized what he said when he was alone in the bathroom.
So then all of this must be a big deal.
Oh, it's a big deal. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, a tragedy struck in French television. Two helicopters involved in a reality series apparently crashed in midair, killing 10 crew members and celebrity contestants. The show dropped stars off. This was the premise of the show. They dropped stars off in the middle of nowhere and told them to survive. In this case, they didn't even make it to the ground after an unexplained mishap. Those involved included well-known athletes and the like. Given the extraordinary amount of TV being filmed all over the world, it's perhaps only surprising that we don't hear of more TV-related accidents all the time. As of yet, there's no indication of lax protocols. Obviously, our sympathies go out to all involved, but in terms of TV and safety, we talked about film and safety last week. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal, even though there's no indication that there was anything, you know, skipped in terms of protocol. Obviously, when something like that happens, you look at what's going on and what you're doing and what you could do to make it safer. So hopefully it's a wake up call that, yeah, you know, you're doing all these shows and all these extraordinary situations. You need to think twice and thrice about what you're doing.
Sometimes people are too nasty. You know that, Michael? They're just too nasty. Sometimes they aren't nasty enough. Worldwide audiences know Jeremy Clarkson as the prickly PC-mocking presenter of Top Gear, a reality series built around cars that is a massive hit in most of the world but little known in the U.S. Clarkson has repeatedly gotten into hot water over racially charged comments he's made while traveling the globe to film the show. But after being warned numerous times he was on thin ice, Clarkson went too far by apparently punching a producer on the show during a conflict.
Wait, that's not allowed?
Apparently not, no.
Oh, I apologize to our producer. I should not have punched him in the nose.
Well yeah, that hurt, by the way. So he apparently punched the producer, and apparently that's, you know, not right.
Okay.
Now, he was suspended immediately, Clarkson was, though almost as immediately, fans started online petitions to call for his return. In contrast, Kathy Griffin quit Fashion Police, a show known for teasing jokes about celebrity outfits because, you know, she wasn't mean enough, apparently. This is the show that lost its host, Joan Rivers, and stumbled after returning to the air with a racially charged comment. I guess that comment was made by one of its hosts. Griffin quit after 7 episodes because she felt she was being pushed into making nasty comments and wasn't comfortable with that. Griffin is known for mocking all things pompous and fab, but body size wasn't one area she was willing to tackle. This comes in the wake of Kelly Osbourne also quitting the show. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whooping scheme of things, you know, and frankly, I'm sure Clarkson will be back. You know what? The show's so big, so successful, you can just be a complete jerk and they're going to do what they can to keep you on the air. He punches a producer and he's suspended. They didn't just fire him and say, you're gone. They're like, well, we'll suspend him. That means to me that the door is open for him to come back because, I mean, what does he have to do to get fired? You know, he's made all these little racial comments over the years, you know, typifying and stereotyping countless countries, lazy Mexicans, I think he said. I mean, the stuff he said is ridiculous, but of course he's still in the air because he's a big hit. Kathy Griffin, however, I thought she was really, really pretty classy. I mean, I love the statement she made. You know, she goes, you know, the show is mean-spirited, and she likes teasing, but she doesn't like mocking differences. And she said, quote, my brand of humor, while unrepentant and unafraid, is all about context. There is plenty to make fun of in pop culture without bringing people's bodies into it. I do not want to use my comedy to contribute to a culture of unattainable perfectionism and intolerance towards difference. I want to help women, gay kids, people of color, and anyone who feels underrepresented to have a voice and a laugh, end quote. So I thought that was, you always think of her sort of just sort of mocking celebrities relentlessly and being mean. You know, she's willing to make fun of anyone, but, you know, she points out she's got a different, you know, it depends who she's making fun of and why.
You know, a couple of years ago, February 2011, I was in Dublin, Ireland. We actually recorded the show there, if you recall.
I do.
And I remember watching Top Gear. It was like the first time I'd ever actually watched a full show, a full episode. And there they are making fun of this Mexican car, you know, that was being made.
Oh, that one. Yeah, I remember. And, yeah, that was one of the big problems. Yeah,
and I thought to myself, as I'm watching, I went, wow, they get away with anything in the United Kingdom. This is remarkable. They can just say whatever they want.
And they love prejudice.
And so I came back thinking nothing of it, thinking, wow, that was pretty remarkable. And I guess 3 weeks later, it aired, that episode aired elsewhere. And boy, it became a hot button.
That's right.
We have to thank piracy. Thank you, piracy. HBO's Game of Thrones will make its 5th season premiere simultaneously in more than 170 countries. HBO touted the enthusiastic fan base for that. We tout the ever-growing threat of piracy. People are happy to pay reasonable amounts of money to watch TV shows, hear music, and so on. But God forbid you make them wait a month or a week or even a day to do so. If it's out there in the world and they can't legally access it, they will go online and do it illegally. We've just seen the music industry arrange a worldwide release date for new music on Fridays because of, you know, even a gap of a few days can mean serious losses from country to country. And now HBO is doing it for its premiere show, Game of Thrones. Now, you pirates in Australia have no excuse. Behave yourself. Big deal or big whoop. And by the way, behaving yourself means no spoilers.
Well, you can't spoil when everybody sees it at the same time. I wonder if it means just like within a 24-hour period, right? They don't mean literally like all the same minute, I
Correct.
Assume.
Correct, yes.
Because, I mean, they did do that with Doctor Who, but I don't think that's what we're talking about here. But it's so close to the same time, you really have no excuse. It's a big deal. I think you're going to see more worldwide releases in movies and TV shows. You know, people don't want to wait. Downton Abbey, they got away with it, and I think it's because it's an older audience. You know, younger people, they wouldn't want to wait. They wouldn't deal with it. They wouldn't wait 4 months to find out what was going on, you know, in Downton Abbey. Game of Thrones, clearly they're not waiting. So, you know, we'll have to see if this becomes a trend, but I think it's inevitable.
Content is king, or should I say master. And everyone wants to be the master of their domain. And if you don't know what show we're talking about by now, I don't know what to say. I, you know, you got to catch up. Now, that's why the possibility of gaining exclusive rights, by the way, to stream episodes of Seinfeld, which is the show we're talking about, has the likes of Hulu and Amazon, and we're going to presume Netflix, chomping at the bit. Sony wants to top the $500,000 per episode that Friends nabbed from Netflix. If so, the entire 172-episode library could come close to $100 million. By some estimates, Seinfeld has generated some $3 billion in syndication fees alone, so I guess that makes the, you know, $100 million deal just kind of like icing on the cake. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop. We've had big ticket items in streaming video on demand. It's not beginning to approach what they make in off-network syndication yet, and in worldwide in deals in country by country, but it's going to keep growing, and eventually it will become a big deal.
British TV giant ITV has purchased the company behind the smash hit talent show, The Voice. ITV bought the company Talpa for $531 million, with the caveat that driving force John DeMol remain heavily involved with the company for the next 8 years. The Voice first aired in the Netherlands in 2010 and is now a hit in more than 180 countries in various local editions. Talpa has other shows and formats, such as the game show I Love My Country, the dating show Dating in the Dark, and a show which could be a game show or a dating show or both called Battle of the Sexes, Big Deal or Big Whoop.
Well, it's a big deal because they made sure they kept John DeMol on board. I mean, that's key to me. You know, it's buying a library or buying a company. You want to make sure the person who's the really creative force there stays on board. And that's what they did. And that was smart. And so I think that's why this could prove to be a valuable purchase. I would assume that The Voice is pretty much at its peak. You know, So you're buying the company really at a high, which is never a smart idea. But hopefully John DeMol can turn out some new properties that are just as valuable down the road.
Well, Michael, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. As we mentioned at the top of the show, last week, a jury ordered Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams to pay the Marvin Gaye estate $7.4 million, claiming their song Blurred Lines was stolen, or at least sounded similar to, Gaye's 1977 hit Got to Give It Up. The decision was described by Eric Gardner, a senior editor at The Hollywood Reporter, as being a landmark legal controversy over songcraft whose verdict will echo through the ages, and I'm kind of paraphrasing there. Anyone who has been listening to Showbiz Sandbox for even a little while knows Eric has become a go-to source for entertainment law, which is why we've been mentioning him on the show for years. Now we're lucky to have Eric joining us in the midst of a hectic South by Southwest schedule to discuss the Blurred Lines verdict and what it may mean for the music industry. Eric, thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
My pleasure.
So I hope we summed that up properly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a very big decision and it caught a lot of people by surprise. But, you know, it's very rare to have a trial like this get to verdict. And so people are paying attention and, you know, wondering what's next.
Isn't it also somewhat rare for the case to actually make it to trial as opposed to settle out of court whenever there's a plagiarism or a kind of a copyright lawsuit? Usually, isn't it settled kind of behind closed doors and we never really find out what happened?
Yeah, there are two big reasons why these disputes never get to trial. First of all, many of the disputes are settled. You know, it costs millions of dollars to actually litigate these controversies. And so, you know, a lot of defendants, a lot of companies decide that it's a better, better expenditure of resources just to, you know, pay, a nominal amount to wrap it up privately. The second reason is judges don't usually tolerate a lot of broad claims. And so you see, you know, many lawsuits of this nature, but, you know, very few where the judge lets the jury decide the issue.
And is that where the case fell apart for the team behind Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams? It feels like, based on a lot of expert testimony, a lot of people are now saying, well, gee, we feel like it should be overturned on appeal. These songs aren't similar. Look at this and this. And yet, of course, they lost the case. So if it's so obvious, we have to wonder, is the one reason they lost the case because it actually went to a jury rather than perhaps a judge?
Well, juries are very unpredictable. They're not trained in the law. They're not trained in music. So, you know, once it gets to a trial, that's in a way a victory for the Marvin Gaye family because, you know, they at least had a 50-50 shot. You know, there was no telling what was going to happen. I'm sure that Pharrell Williams and Robin Thicke would have liked to have concluded the case on summary judgment where they argued that no reasonable juror could have found any copyright infringement. So, you know, it's definitely, you know, I wouldn't say that things fell apart because, you know, there was still a lot of testimony on the Pharrell Williams side that, you know, that songs weren't similar and such. But, you know, it certainly, once it gets to that stage, anything goes. And, you know, that's what we see here.
Well, now let me ask you something, because that makes an interesting point. Every position I read by musicologists or people who are experts in music theory or musicians said, we don't know how copyright is supposed to work then, because the jury says it's a copyright infringement. But the reality is, if you look at the actual musical notes, there's nothing similar about them. And if you look at, you know, musical theory, there's nothing similar about them. Blurred Lines is 120 beats per minute. Got to Give It Up is 122 beats. And one musicologist goes on and on about pentatonic scales and the difference between the two. At some point, doesn't that kind of have to come into play, jury or not? Don't you have to kind of go back and say, well, it's nice the jury thought they looked similar. Obviously, they couldn't sound similar since they weren't allowed to actually play the music, but they're actually not similar at all.
Well, there's certainly evidence going to similarity and evidence cutting away from similarity, and the actual notes and whether they're identical is just one aspect of it. There are, you know, many aspects of a song, from the hook to the lyrics to, you know, the sound of the beat, the bass line. And, you know, even though there might not be exact identicality, the standard really for copyright infringement is what's called substantial similarity. And that's kind of a vague term that, you know, juries can differ on their opinions. In this case, you know, musicologists disagreed. You know, the Marvin Gaye estate went to a few different musicologists before they found, you know, a couple who agreed that it was that the songs were similar. So, you know, there's all sorts of evidence proffered by both sides about, you know, fighting over the details about, you know, why, you know, why a jury should find that there's copyright infringement. And the other quirk of this case was that the Marvin Gaye family didn't own rights to the sound recording. They just owned rights to the composition. So that really meant, you know, a bit more focus on the sheet music and the notes and what was written there. You know, they actually were able to introduce some audio into the trial, not the original songs that we're all familiar with, but just the stripped down versions of the songs, where only the elements protected by the sheet music deposited with the Copyright Office. So the jury did get a small sense of what the songs listened to. But from my understanding, once they started deliberating, they never actually asked again to listen to the music, which is kind of interesting and weird. You would think that if you're a juror, that's one of the things you'd be asking for is to actually listen.
Well, now let me ask you, just to stick with that for a moment, about the fact that you can't copyright rhythm, apparently, but you can copyright sheet music and lyrics. And Tim Wu, he's a law professor at the Columbia Law School. He also he kind of writes about technology. He's written a book called The Master Switch, quite a good book. And he believes that the Blurred Lines copyright verdict should be thrown out. Because, and this is a quote, he says, there was a serious error has been made. The judge overseeing the case should never have let the case go before a jury. The ruling against Thicke was a mistake, and it should and likely will be reversed on appeal, specifically because he writes that they were suing about the similarity as opposed to the audio rather than the similarity of the sheet music.
Right. You know, I respect what Tim Wu does, and he's great. I think he's a little off on what the grounds of appeal will be. I don't think that the appeal is going to be that, and that the judge should have never have let it go to jury. I think what the grounds of appeal are going to be is that that the trial, you know, expanded the scope from what was in the copyrighted sheet music to some of the audio. I think that Pharrell Williams is going to try to say that there was an error in how the evidence was presented and what the musicologists testified to, that when they did their analysis of the two songs, they were treading onto some of the non-protected ground. It's going, you know, it's going to be tough because, you know, a lot of jury verdicts withstand, appeals scrutiny, especially in copyright cases where the appeals court, you know, will mainly just be looking at whether the judge made, an error in judgment and whether there was any prejudice to the litigants. So the presumption at least is for the winning side, and the appeals court is really going to have to find, error to overturn that. And in the meantime, there's going to be all sorts of pressure on the Pharrell Williams side to maybe settle the case. Right now they are going for an injunction. I think that's a bit iffy, but you know, in the meantime, the legal costs are going to rack up, and it could cause a bit of problems on the distribution end of the song. So we'll see. It's not clear to me that it's going to be reversed on appeal.
And that's why this is going to be a landmark case. If it stands, they will have sort of expanded the idea of what can be copyrighted. The lawyer, Richard Bush, was involved in an earlier case that involved sampling, and that set a new standard where basically after the verdict that he won, it was clear if you take even a little tiny bit of a song and sample it, you better get a clearance. And in this case, it feels like they've expanded the idea of, say, hey, if you're really capturing the vibe of a song and people listen to it and say, yeah, that feels like that other song, you're on dangerous territory. And that wasn't the case before, was it?
Yeah, well, I think that precedent, we have to be careful here. I think the precedent mainly is a big PR one. I think that people will pay attention to this case, and I think it will bolster the confidence of, you know, songwriters and recording artists who may wish to sue. It might you know, lead them to the thought that there are a lot of money damages available and that you can win. But I don't necessarily think it's going to become any more easier for plaintiffs to win these types of cases. There's nothing itself about the jury verdict that has precedential value. There, you know, in future court cases, they're not going to, you know, point to the jury verdict and say, you know, they found the, you know, copyright infringement there, and our case is like that. So you know, we have to be a little bit careful. There could be precedent depending on what happens in the appellate review, as you know, a judge, higher authorities start, you know, parsing, you know, what is copyright infringement and what's a, you know, feel and all that. So that it's mm-hmm. possible. I mean, the earlier case by the lawyer who represented the Marvin Gaye district, that went up to appeal. And when people talk about the precedent from that case, it's mainly because there was an appellate decision about, you know, get a license or don't sample. And, you know, that ruling is still controversial to its day. It's a holding in one circuit in this nation, but there are other circuits in the nation that have gone the other way where, you know, even small bits of sampling are permissible as de minimis fair use.
Well, so then I guess the big outcry was, or the big, as you say, the PR that's spin out of this was that the Mark Ronsons or the Bruno Marses, who kind of play off of previous eras and their homages, they'd have to be a little bit more careful about recreating that feeling and that vibe, lest they be sued. You're saying, well, that may not be so true.
Well, I think that there certainly will be a bit more, you know, carefulness in the studio to document, what exactly is taking place. Maybe a bit more carefulness in how artists promote their songs, where they may not talk about their inspiration quite as much. I think that whenever there is the chance to, you know, get insurance, I think the insurers are going to be asking questions about, could this possibly lead to claims? I think that demand letters might be taken a little bit more seriously. But at the end of the day, when these disputes actually go to a courtroom, I don't necessarily think that that defendants are, they shouldn't be panicking right now. There's still, you know, hundreds and even thousands of unsuccessful lawsuits where, you know, plaintiffs are alleging similarity in unprotected generic ideas. And, you know, those lawsuits fail. And, you know, the big difference here is that, you know, Marvin Gaye was such a big musician. Pharrell Williams and Robin Thicke had to have had access to the song. There was no real question that they had knowledge of that previous song. So the judge, you know, respected Marvin Gaye's name and let a jury decide in future cases that that might not necessarily be the same standard. Judges in those cases might, you know, put more of an onus on the plaintiffs to actually show similarity before they throw it to a jury.
Well, one of my favorite parts of Hollywood Reporter's coverage of this was after the verdict. You guys got Richard Bush to pen a guest column talking about how we won the case. And I read that and I thought, oh, this is going to drive the other team nuts. Because he says, gee, I have no idea why they sued us and made other claims. And sure enough, a few days later, the other side, represented by Howard King, penned their own guest column. Did you reach out to Richard Bush first? And did the other people say yes after they saw his column? Or how did that all happen?
Yeah. Well, you know, I have good relations with lots of lawyers in Hollywood, including the ones in this case. After, you know, Richard won the case, I reached out to him and wanted to see whether he'd do that. And he of course agreed. And as that was coming, I also figured that the other side was going to want a chance to respond, and Howard agreed as well. On the other hand, I don't necessarily want to move the dispute from a courtroom to the pages of Hollywood Reporter. As great as that might seem, you know, at certain points you don't want the disputes going back and forth, where things get ugly. But, you know, it's a very good opportunity for people to hear from the actual people involved in the case about their breakdowns and why they think they were successful or not successful, and an inside look in what actually happened.
And now, is that somewhat unusual in a case where everybody claims there's going to be an appeal. So in a way, it's over, but not over. So is it unusual for lawyers to be speaking, especially to the press? And in this case, they are speaking directly from the press in cases such as this?
Not after a verdict, I think. I think that, you know, at that point, you know, people want to put the best light on what happened and take credit or frame what happened so that there's a better understanding of it. But, you know, during the course of things, you know, lawyers certainly can clam up and decide that it's not in their best interest to fight things as publicly, especially because the judges pay attention to that sort of thing, and they're leery of pissing off the judge and characterizing what the judge does before the judge has fully concluded the proceedings. In this case, it was a very highly public case, and you know, I was the one who originally reported that there was a lawsuit in the first place, and you know, and there was a lot of interesting theatrics throughout the pretrial phase, from the revelations of Robin Thicke's depositions to other aspects of the case that have almost been forgotten by now. The fact that the publisher was sued because of alleged conflict of interest for representing both sides. They also know me personally, that I pay very close attention to this sort of stuff, and I'm going to report it one way or the other. They want to, get on top of it and make sure that, their side is presented fairly.
And of course, this isn't necessarily the end of it. We know that there's a likely appeal, and the Gaye estate said, hey, you know what, by the way, that Pharrell Williams song, Happy, that sounds a lot like Marvin Gaye's Ain't That Peculiar.
Yeah, well, from what I hear, the happy thing right now is pure hype. There's no plans at the moment for a lawsuit, but yeah, there, you know, there's probably going to be appellate papers filed, you know, in the coming weeks, and you know, these cases can take a very long time, so don't be surprised if it, you know, if it goes on for another year or two, where you know, everyone's fighting over what happened at trial, you know, and if there is a reversal by the appellate court, then there's always the possibility of another trial as well.
Well, you know, I always think every now and again, well, they're going to run out of things for Eric Gardner to write about over there at the Esquire blog at the Hollywood Reporter. And I'm never surprised, though, when yet another big case comes along. And of course, whenever one does, your blog is the first place I turn to figure out what's going on. You do a great job over there at the Hollywood Reporter. And I wanted to personally thank you for taking the time to speak with us about the Blurred Lines verdict, which occurred last week.
Absolutely. My pleasure. I try to do the best work I can and stay on top of all this. And I'm glad to hear that people get a lot out of it.
Oh, absolutely. And we'll place links to your stories in our show notes, as well as your Twitter account is Eric Gardner. And that's Eric with a Q instead of a C. You can follow Eric there. And of course, definitely check him out at The Hollywood Reporter.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for your time. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
All right. Well, that was great of Eric Gardner to stop by while he's busy covering South by Southwest. Is there a lot of legal news made at South by Southwest, or what's he doing there?
I'm not sure. They have a whole interactive portion, so I think maybe he's sitting on a panel or two. I don't know, but it's, you know, heck, if you get the chance to go to South by Southwest, why wouldn't you take it?
Yeah, I've never been, so I'd love to sometime.
Yeah, I mean, and to say that I have wanted to, you know, we've wanted to have him on. We've talked about it for years, so it's great to finally get him on, especially with such a big case like the Blurred Lines verdict.
It is a really interesting one. But of course, we got to move on.
You think we should play a mashup of the two just to...
I'd rather not.
Well, are you sure? Because, you know, I don't know. Well, you know, the problem is I don't know where copyright would fall on that.
Fair use, you mean?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe we should just skip it. Otherwise, you know, I hear the Marvin Gaye family somewhat, you know, litigious these days.
That's right. Of course, that's the late Marvin Gaye. And
that's true.
We are talking about obituaries. There are a lot of obituaries this week. And frankly, it's just, as we sort of try to do, obviously, when really famous people die, you mention it or you think about it, you try to bring some personal anecdote. But when it's other people, it's kind of like what fascinating, interesting careers they have, and you may not have even noticed. You know, we may not know a lot about them, and you learn about them when they die, and you sort of get reminded of the impact that they've had on the industry. There's a lot of cool people this week. The first one is pretty well known. It's Richard Glatzer.
Richard Glatzer.
Yeah. He is the co-writer and co-director of Still Alice, which won the Oscar for Best Actress. He died. He was diagnosed with ALS while working on the project, and he headed into the hospital 2 days before it won the Best Actress statue at the Academy Awards. Now, that is good gay timing. You know, if you want to be dramatic, you enter the hospital just a few days before the Oscars. You watch this ceremony from your hospital bed. You know, so he went out on a high, to say the least.
Yeah. In fact, Julianne Moore, when she won the Best Actress for this film, thanked him and mentioned the fact that he was not doing well.
Yeah. So we knew this was going to happen. But of course, it's very sad news for all involved. And your sympathies go out to his husband, Wash Westmoreland, who's the guy who co-wrote and co-directed the movie with him.
Yes. And that brings us to Leah Van Leer, who is somebody I don't know anything about her. So I'm going to actually turn this over to Michael, since I don't know anything about Leah Van Leer.
Well, she's a big figure in the Israeli film industry. You know, we always try to focus on the world, and we did a good job this week, I think. We talked about China and the worldwide box office. We talked about TV shows, you know, the French TV and UK TV. Here we are talking about the Israeli film industry. And if you're in that country or in that film industry, you know Leah Van Leer. She's a big figure. She started like film clubs in her living room with her husband, and that went on to grow into the Jerusalem Cinematheque. She also launched the country's first film archive and in the Jerusalem Film Festival in 1984. So she is a big, big figure in the Israeli film industry. And there are people like her all over the world making film grow country by country, which is really important because you get world-class talent springing out of all those places. You've got TV shows like Homeland. That sprang from Israel. And I'm sure that there's a link to that show and Leah Van Leer in some way, shape, or form.
Now, speaking of television shows, The Simpsons has been on, what, 25 some odd years now?
That's 30? Right.
Sam Simon, I guess I don't know whether he was a creator or he's been with the show for as long as I can remember. He died at 59 from colon cancer. And he was much beloved in the television industry and, frankly, in Hollywood.
Well, yeah, he was. I mean, obviously, it wasn't just The Simpsons. He also wrote episodes of Taxis and Cheers. He was a writer and producer on those two. Those are two classic sitcoms. And then he worked for four seasons on The Simpsons, and he was really key in developing the show because Matt Groening, obviously, is not a TV guy. But James L. Brooks produced it because it came off from the Tracy Ullman show. And, you know, they were trying to turn this into a sitcom, animated show, and they weren't sure it would work, and he thought it would only last a season, and that kind of really pissed off Matt Groening. But apparently, he was a real pain in the ass to work with. Everyone said so, including Sam Simon himself. But he worked on the show. He was really key in forging its style. He insisted on cast readings, which wasn't always done for animated shows. But he insisted on everybody getting together so the actors could play off each other and they could be an ensemble. And he insisted that writers work in the room together, just like on live sitcoms. That's what he knew on Taxi and Cheers, and that's what he wanted on The Simpsons. And everybody agrees that he was a really important force on the TV show, and yet he left after 4 years, didn't he?
Yeah, and I guess, you know, I say he's been with them forever only because his reputation and his career has been linked to that show ever since.
That's right. So, you know, he left the show, and he was one of the three creators. The creators are listed as James L. Brooks, Sam Simon, and, of course, Matt Groening,
yeah,
who created the comic strip that it's based on. And he was there for 4 years, and he left with a big, big lucrative deal. Apparently, they were happy to have him go and gave him the moon. He would net tens of millions of dollars a year. And you know what? He did a lot with it. He gave a lot to charity. He gave money away when he learned he had colon cancer. You know, he lived a good life. He married and divorced an actress and competitive poker player. That's Jennifer Tilly. We know her as an actress, but she also is a serious poker player. And that was a big thing for him. He did that a lot. And he also married a Playboy model, though they also divorced. He was on Howard Stern a lot. He grew up in Beverly Hills across the street from Groucho Marx, you know. And, you know, it's sort of a fabled beginning to his career. He wrote a spec script for Taxi, sent it in unsolicited, and they did it. They made the episode, and they hired him.
Yeah, that is a auspicious start there.
Yeah, certainly. And that, you know, to keep in mind, that was one of the best shows on television at the time and is still, you know, really beloved by people who love great sitcoms.
Well, now, a little aside, I have a confession to make. I have been binge-watching The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
Oh, okay.
Now, the tie there is that Carol Kane was on Taxi.
Yes, she was. Oh, is she in that show,
And too? She's in that show. And quite good, I will say.
How is it?
It's very good. And that's why I've been binge-watching it. I'm almost done.
I don't think it's much in syndication or reruns anywhere. It must be on some game show network or something. But did you ever watch The Gong Show?
Yes, I did.
You did. So you know who Gene the Dancing Machine is.
Yes.
As soon as this guy died, his name is Gene Patton, and he was a guy who would appear on The Gong Show. People who are young were like, what is The Gong Show? And then you mentioned the George Clooney film, you know, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, and they sort of have a vague awareness of that. But this was a really oddball TV show in the late 70s, and it was created by Chuck Barris, and basically it was a talent show, but they had bad talent. They had low-rent celebrities who'd be there to judge. People would come on, and most of them were terrible at what they did, and the judges would hit a gong when they got sick of it and make them go away.
Yes, pretty much.
That was the premise of the show. I don't know why we watched it, but we did. And then every once in a while, Chuck Barris, who was the host as well as the creator, he looked like he was stoned most of the time. He really was. And every once in a while, he would just stop and go, what's that? And he'd look up and go, what? He goes, it's Gene the Dancing Machine. And this guy who worked backstage, just a crew member, would come out on stage and start dancing. They'd play this old song by Count Basie. It was a cover of Jumping at the Woodside. And everybody would dance. The judges would dance. Chuck Barris would dance. The whole audience got up and danced. It was just ridiculous. It was kind of surreal.
Well, isn't that what the Saturday Night Live skit, you know, the what's up with that? Where they all start dancing, and it's like, what's going on here? Why is everybody dancing all of a sudden?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't seen that.
It's kind of where that came from, I thought.
So Gene Patton died at 82. He suffered from diabetes. He lost both legs. And it wasn't, you know, just he had this novelty thing, of course, being Gene the Dancing Machine, which is sort of a bizarre, you know, celebrityhood. But he was also the first African-American to become a member of the International Alliance of Theatrical and Stage Employees, Local 33, back in 1969. So he was also a groundbreaker. So we're a lot of sympathies this week, but our thoughts go out to his family.
What about Jenna McMahon? She died at 89. She was partnered with Dick Clare on stage and in life, by the way, as sort of a Nicholas and May comedy team.
Nicholas and May.
Yeah, I don't know. When I read that, I was like, Nicholas. I don't think so. They worked together on TV, actually, and they won 3 Emmys writing for The Carol Burnett Show.
Yeah, as far as variety shows, that's about as good as it gets. They did scripts for The Mary Tyler Moore Show, The Bob Newhart Show, Maude, and Soap. And that's classy territory when you're talking the 70s. That's the heyday, the greatest era for sitcoms. I think that's unquestioned. And they worked for all the greats. And then Carol Burnett said, "You guys are great." And she hired them for her variety show. They won 3 Emmys. And they went on to a lot of other stuff. They created like 3 really big hits. One was Mama's Family. Another was The Facts of Life, which they wrote the spinoff from Different Strokes for that one and then created that show. And also It's a Living, which was about, were they stewardesses or waitresses? I think they were waitresses. That's what it was. And the funny and interesting thing here is that Mama's Family and It's a Living were both really big hits in first-run syndication. Mama's Family started on a network, then jumped to syndication. I think It's a Living started in syndication, which was a sort of an unexplored territory at the time. I mean, people were always trying it and doing it a little bit, but they really had success in it. And that was where their big payday came from. But her husband, Dick Clare, died many years ago. He died in 1988. This is the stuff you don't learn until you read an obituary. He died, almost 30 years ago of AIDS-related illnesses and had his body frozen in hopes of being revived again. Man, you haven't heard about anybody doing that in a long time. And I hope they've set up a trust fund. They've got the money because now that she's gone, someone's got to pay attention to his body. I don't know where it is or what's going on, but, you know, that's kind of interesting. I mean, haven't we sort of dealt with AIDS-related illnesses? Maybe it's time to wake them up again.
I'll leave that to you. And in the meantime, I'm going to tell our listeners about Terry Pratchett, who passed away at the age of 66. He was fighting Alzheimer's.
Which he called an embuggerance. Right. Sir Terry Pratchett, I should say. He was knighted. He is a very famous British novelist. In the 90s, he was the best-selling author in Britain until J.K. Rowling came along. But he wrote fantasy novels, comic fantasy novels, which the U.S. doesn't really have a good tradition of. But in the U.K., they love it. And one of the main reasons is Terry Pratchett. He is, you know, you often call people when they die beloved. He truly was beloved. He wrote dozens and dozens of books set in Discworld, which is a frisbee-shaped land placed on top of 4 elephants who are sitting on top of the shell of a very large turtle. That is the Discworld. And he set a lot of books there. It sold about 80 million copies around the world. He's just, you know, we like to have a worldwide scope. And if you're talking about big things that happened in the past week and big cultural figures that have gone, you know, we touched on one from Israel. This guy is, you know, front page news in the UK. Very sad. But we knew it was happening because he hadn't been well for a while. And I love it. He's a funny guy. And his books often have death in them. Death is a big character. He keeps showing up in Discworld all the time. He's very funny. He usually speaks in all caps. I don't know why, but he does. Not that he's yelling. This started long before the internet. So it's just the conceit. And death showed up in his final tweets, which were sent out after he died. Clearly, it was something he planned in advance.
Yes, I love the all caps part, though.
That's right. And what did the tweet say?
It said, and it's all caps, so it must be death talking. "At last, Sir Terry, we must walk together."
That's right. And then the second tweet went to normal text and it said, "Terry took death's arm and followed him through the doors and onto the black desert under the endless night."
And then the final one read, "The end." Period.
That's what it's just, I mean, you know, can you imagine? That's just you're a fan following him on Twitter, and those are the last 3 tweets you get from Terry Pratchett. So, you know, way to go out on a classy note.
I find, you know, what with Leonard Nimoy kind of saying "live long and prosper" just before he passed away, and people are trying to outdo themselves as they depart the world here on Twitter. Have you noticed
that's
that?
Right. Well, the Times for a while has been doing video interviews with people who know they're dying. You know, you often interview people because you want to prepare their obituary. That's something celebrities face where they realize suddenly someone has come to chat with them from the Times and they know it's for the obit, but it's never really, sometimes I think they say it and talk about it and sometimes they don't. But they've also been doing video ones where people who are dying say, "Hey," they say, "let's do a video where you talk about your life and talk about the fact that you're dying." So that's been sort of a tradition. But Sperling, if you die and you're going to tweet, what your final tweet should be, what? Play nice?
Play nice, yeah, I guess.
I need to come up with a catchphrase.
You know, I noticed that they started doing, I learned that they did that whole pre-interview before someone passed away, sometimes decades before they passed away. I noticed that I was working with Jane Fonda, or, you know, I was working at an agency and Jane Fonda was a client, And I was trying to schedule something with her, and she said, oh, I can't do this audition at that time or go to that reading at that time because the New York Times is coming to interview me for Katharine Hepburn's obituary. I said, oh, she passed away? And I was like 22, 23, and she said, no, this just, in case she passes away.
For when? In case.
Yeah.
She might live forever.
And I thought, wait, what? Wait, she hasn't passed away, but you're doing an interview for her obituary, which is being written before she... That's morbid. And that's when I first began to realize, okay, they actually...
You got to have them on file because you never, when the people get older, eventually in 10 or 15 years, it's going to happen. And you can't interview everybody the day it happens. Now, of course, you can just quote their tweets.
Well, you mentioned the New York Times, and I can't remember. I think it was a playwright. I can't remember who it was that said, if you're seeing this, that means I'm dead. it was like one of the first ones. And I thought that was actually, and it was like a comedic writer. And I thought that's actually very funny.
So the end comes to all, and it even comes to shows, doesn't it?
I know you've been trying to bring us to a close here for some time. But, Michael, you did mention that we talked a lot about some international stories on this show. And if you want us to, if we overlook an international story, please let us know. You can write to us, and we read your emails in each show. dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Again, that's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Send us feedback. Let us know what we're missing. Send us love letters, etc. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, wherever they give podcasts away for free. If you have a mobile app to listen to podcasts, we're usually found there. Please do subscribe to the show, rate and review the show. It does help us out in all of those podcast distributors and aggregators. Those links, ways to subscribe to the show, ways to contact us, ways to follow us. You can follow us on Twitter, @ShowbizSandbox is our handle. Or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. All of that information, as well as links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, and links to the work of Eric Gardner from The Hollywood Reporter. I'd like to thank him for joining us to talk about the Blurred Lines verdict a few minutes ago. Greatly appreciate that. All of this information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and if you're not over at the Huffington Post reading Michael's reporting and coverage of the entertainment industry, or over at his website, michaelgiltz.com, sometimes he can be found where, Michael?
Discworldforever.com, which I imagine is actually probably a real website.
Actually, Michael just helped boost the numbers for what is likely a real website that has nothing to do with Michael Giltz. However, some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week. Play nice.